Epilogue. Valazode, as prime controller of the elected assembly, was supposed to be the most powerful being on the planet Monrome, homeworld of the Dione people, center of culture for the entire superiority. Yes, there were superiority officers ranked higher than Valazode was, but they were out of contact right now. The superiority was a mess anyway, so Valazode, well, they should have been the most important person around. They didn't feel like it. Instead, they felt strangely cold as the others led them through the primary communications node on Byled. Now a mess of broken open machinery, holes ripped into it like the hearts had been taken out for surgery. It was a cold, icy thing to realize you, the most powerful person on a planet, were helpless. "All of our communication systems," Lekalid said softly, gesturing to another set of ripped open machines. "Everyone on the planet, even in the secret places of intelligence, they're all like this, vandalized in a moment last night." Valazode bared their teeth, something they prided themselves on never doing, so uncivilized it felt. But what other response was there?
"Same with the hyperdrives?" Valazode asked.
The other Dions in the room nodded. Something, a force they didn't understand, had ripped into every ship in the system and taken out the hyperdrives and the inhibitors and every other secret piece of biological technology on the planet. Somehow, this force had found them all, no matter how hidden. It was like nothing else ever recorded. If reports were true, scattered and fragmentary as they'd been before communications had shut down, then this was happening all across the superiority. Worse, something terrible and terrifying was involved. Delvers. Valazode left the room and stepped out onto a balcony, formal coat rustling as they put their hands on the railing and looked out over a sea of lights. Light to push back the darkness. Ever since the Dions had achieved prime intelligence, they had been a light to the galaxy, pushing back the twin darknesses of barbarism and aggression. Now, Valazode was scared, terrified.
"What do we do?"
Joxerma said, walking up, terror painted on their bifurcated face, half blue, half red. They were adraft, doing an internship. It was supposed to have been an easy couple of weeks for them to prove themselves. That had been before the reports had started coming in. First, an assault on the secret superiority Tainix storage facility a few days back. Then terror around the galaxy. Now this? Valazode looked up at the sky, stars twinkling high above. It had been a long, long time since a Dion had looked up there and been frightened. They'd mastered their universe, claimed it, until now.
"We're trapped,"
Valazode whispered, taking it in, realizing it fully.
"No communications off-planet, no way to hyperjump. It would take decades to reach the next star system without a hyperdrive. We're alone."
The others quieted, then began whispering in terror, until a star fell from the sky. Then another, and more. Starfighters? Were they saved? Valazode hurried to where the fighters landed, but this was no salvation. They found a group of people, mostly humans, led by a tall female with short hair. She held a Tainix in a special sling at her side, matching her uniform. Out in the open, it made Valazode's skin crawl. Those things were supposed to be kept hidden.
"Ah," she said, as Valazode climbed from the hover car.
"Minister Valazode, at last?"
"Yes,"
Valazode said, forcing those teeth to remain unbared. The human bared hers, brazenly.
"I'm Provisional Ambassador Freya Martin, commander in the Defiant Military. Call sign FM, if it matters."
"Does it?"
She gave a human shrug of the shoulders. Just here to impart a little explanation. Food deliveries will be incoming, as I understand your planet is too populated to feed itself. You'll want to arrange for the distribution, and you can send requests for other supplies. If we determine they legitimately can't be produced locally, we'll accommodate the requests. The rest of the terms are here. She set a datapad on a table nearby. One of the guards moved to take a shot at her, a terribly aggressive act, and it would have horrified Valazode under other circumstances. But well, this was a human. The human seemed to have been ready for it. Before the guard pulled the trigger, the human vanished. The shot zipped through empty air. The human appeared next to the Dione with the gun and pointedly took the weapon from their stunned hands. That Tanix. It knew how to hyperjump on command without needing any equipment to corral it. So dangerous, so aggressive. "That was annoying of you," the human said. "If you keep acting like this, you'll never get off-world. And I was assured by your kind it was safe to visit you in person." She stalked back toward her ship. "Human," Valazode called. "Wait, wait. I apologize for this craven act of aggression, but please, when do we get to leave our planet again?"
"It's not up to me, so I can't say," the human said, pausing by her ship. The others were already climbing into theirs.
"Who is it up to?" Valazode said. "Can I speak to your government? Plead our case. We didn't know what Winzik was doing. We didn't condone his war. We are victims."
"This isn't about his war," she said. "It's about what you've done as a society. And it's not our government who gets to decide when you're allowed off planet again."
"Then who?" Valazode demanded.
The human gestured to her sling, and the Tanix inside who fluted out, "Who?" Valazode's horror grew more overpowering.
The hyperdrives decide?"
"Yep," she said, climbing up to her cockpit. "Good luck."
"Oh. Oh, no."
1 week after the victory at Evensong, I stood overseeing yet another delivery of slugs, and I tried to pretend that nothing was wrong with me. After all, things were great. The Delvers had taken their duty to heart, and their first act of compassion involved saving the Tanix, rescuing every hyperdrive that wanted to be rescued, and the other types, every single one of them, in the galaxy. "It's a good thing we have a whole planet full of places like this," I said, standing at an outcropping overlooking a cavern on Detritus, one of the many I'd explored as a kid. It was now packed with happily fluting slugs feasting on bins of mushrooms and algae. Jorgen stepped up beside me, holding a datapad, which was full of statistics about caverns that could be turned into Tanix housing. Based on our estimates, we'd have to find room for several hundred thousand Tanix. Not impossible, but it would be difficult to ramp up the wholesale agricultural operations necessary to provide food for them all. Fortunately, there was already a robust system of food delivery across the galaxy, and there were enough Tanix willing to continue doing their jobs for now to keep that running. So long as we gave them freedom and let them take breaks, with others taking turns. That meant there would be no interruptions in food supplies, though many luxuries would have to stop being traded for now. Indeed, there would be complications, as the planets providing the food weren't being fairly compensated, though initial talks with all of them found the people there excited by the idea of being able to trade their food for more unfettered access to travel. With all this, Jorgen was certain he could hold mass starvation at bay across the galaxy. Regardless, for now, we'd be able to feed the Tanix with shipments from off-planet, and it seemed detritus could work perfectly for growing a crop favored by the Tanix. Mushrooms. Jorgen smiled. He liked a challenge, and this was the perfect one for him. An organizational nightmare, perhaps, but running what was essentially the biggest refugee camp in the galaxy was going to take ingenuity, plus the invention of a ton of new rules. He'd only oversee it, while others did much of the work. He would be stuck with a large number of duties in the newly forming Galactic Alliance. There was talk of a new government to replace the superiority, but it was way too soon for something like that. For now, it was just an alliance, with some shared rules and a moderator running a kind of galactic forum. Nobody wanted a human in that position, of course, though they didn't say it outright. Fortunately, Rinnakeen of the Erdale was extremely well-liked. He was the most likely candidate to run the thing. The humans from Detritus and the other human preserves would have to find their way in what this was becoming. Once, I would have said we'd end up as soldiers, and certainly we'd need to keep up our space forces, but we had another specialty these days. Slug care. Scud. My stomach twisted. I fought it down.
This is going to be their planet, Jorgen said. As it always kind of was. We're just here to help.
And try to figure out what the terms mean, I said. He nodded, his expression a little more grim. The Tanix and the Delvers had a treaty, one that didn't include the rest of us. It involved how often and how quickly the slugs would hyperjump anyone but themselves to prevent too much somewhere incursion into the nowhere. Most of the Delvers didn't feel pain when we traveled to nowhere any longer, but some did, as they'd refused our help, which was, I suppose, their right. And collectively, the Delvers were asserting that the nowhere was their territory. It had existed outside of time and space before their arrival, and they liked it that way, even healing as they were. I wasn't certain it was right for them to claim an entire dimension. But at the same time, what right did any of us have to the land or the airspace that we claimed? They were willing to work with us, but I'd essentially shattered them into a ton of arguing individuals. They were much more aligned than any other species because of their origins, but still, things would be complicated for a while. Regardless, hyperjumping, at least with the Tanix, was going to be limited going forward. The Tanix would give a warning to the Delvers, then wait for permission. So far, that permission could take anywhere from a few seconds to a half hour, though it could in some cases be arranged ahead of time. Both groups were undecided on what to do about Cytonics, like me. We might have to negotiate our own treaty or risk their wrath. Again, it was uncertain. Still, having answers and some measure of safety from the Delvers felt good. So I tried to keep my stress and worry from showing as I joined Jorgen in the lift, heading back to the surface.
"Is this about us?" he asked. "How tense you are?"
"Scud," he'd noticed. So I took him by the arm, made him lean down, and kissed him. "Not about us." He relaxed.
"Good."
"I'm fine," I said. "Just getting used to the new role. Slug wrangler."
"Doesn't seem to fit into Grand Grand stories," he said.
"I don't have to live as if I'm in those stories," I said. "I've grown beyond that."
"You're still you."
"The me I am is happy to be here," I said. "With you. Just give me time. I'll get used to things being boring. Kimmelin says boring is good. She can't shut up about it. The saint apparently had lots to say about doing nothing being nothing to do."
"I don't even know what that means," he said, but kissed me again.
For a moment, that was enough. I lost myself in his warmth, in the press of his lips on mine, his pulse matching mine. I held on to him, feeling embarrassed and thrilled all at once that the doors to the elevator could open at any time, exposing our moment of intimacy. I loved him, genuinely. I wanted to be with him forever. It was just, well, everything else. The world wasn't ending, and I seemed to thrive when it was. What an absolutely terrible personality attribute to have. We finally, with effort, stopped kissing
as the elevator slowed and we arrived at Alta Base. Arm in arm, we stepped out and turned along the path. We still used Jorgen's old garage and his hover car that was inside. He kept talking about learning to tinker with it as a hobby, something people were able to have when they weren't at war. He talked about seeing how high he could get it to fly, as if he couldn't demand a starfighter at any moment. Just before we reached the garage, his comm beeped. He gave me a chagrined look, but I left him to it. Some new species we were approaching, wanting seats in the new Galactic Forum. I wandered over to his garage, then past it to the adjacent hangar. It was big enough for two ships. Inside, Embot, still in his ship form, was chatting with Hesho, who was sitting on the wing, sharpening a sword. The Kitson waved as I entered, and Doomslug fluted from beside him, making a sound like the scraping of the sword on stone. Behind them was another ship, Chet's. He stood up from the cockpit, wearing overalls and a cap, his vibrant mustaches extending from beneath his nose. "Bother," he said. "You realize how annoying shaving is? I never had to do that when I didn't have a real physical presence, Miss Nightshade. It is most uncomfortable." Turned out, Delvers weren't limited to making stone and rock. Chet was having fun learning to be human. And by fun, I meant he was mostly making all the same annoying observations about human bodies that I'd spent months hearing from Embot. At least in Chet's case, the complaints seemed more commiserative. For example, he hadn't realized that if you didn't sleep, you got headaches. I picked up a cloth and started cleaning Embot, who needed a good mopping up after our last flight to inspect a distant set of caverns. I worked in silence for a time, enjoying the quiet moment, when Raj called. "Yo, Rig," I said, as Embot piped through the comm. "How's life untangling the mysteries of the universe?" "Ugh," he said. "That good? FM keeps going down in person and getting shot at," he said. "What is with her?" "She just wants the excitement," I said.
"That's not what she says."
"What does she say?"
"That she needs to ensure personally that the instructions are received by the proper authorities."
"Excitement," I said. I empathize.
"It can't be getting dull for you already, Spensa," he said. "It's only been a few days."
"Longer than I've ever gone without getting shot at."
"Liar," he said. "You realize I've known you most of your life, right?"
"Then you know that I'm prone to exaggeration," I said. "So what's new?" He chuckled.
"Well, I just wanted to let you know I've sent Jorgen something interesting. It might help."
I frowned. "What?"
"He asked for it, and I found it in all of this massive information we're getting from the Superiority's primary databases. Just try not to break anything. Rig out. Thanks, by the way."
"For?"
"For dragging me into this."
He cut the line. I was left confused as Jorgen walked back in carrying a data pad. "All right," I said, hands on my hips. "What scheming have you two been doing?" He turned it toward me. It seemed to be a list of coordinates.
"Unexplored planets," he said. "Deemed too dangerous by the Superiority. There's practically nothing listed about them other than warnings to stay away." Which could mean, I said, snatching it.
Anything, he said. From a Tanix refuge to some kind of very aggressive species to who knows what they determined was too dangerous to even record. Seems mysterious to me.
I took it, then looked at him, narrowing my eyes. You just want to keep me busy.
Of course I want to keep you busy, he said. Doing something important.
He rapped the data pad.
Earth is out there somewhere, Spencer. Either in the nowhere or here. Something happened with it. And the figments, we know next to nothing about them. And what about the traps we found on the portals into the nowhere? Those have existed far longer than the Delvers. There might be dangers out there we don't know about. Better to explore them than to be surprised.
I grinned, then paused and looked at him.
What?
He said. I can't go alone.
Kimmelin, despite what she says, is bored of being bored. And I suspect Chet wants to go do some humaning.
Right you are, he called.
So, Jorgen said, you won't go alone.
I felt an immediate thrill, then paused. Will this interfere with us if I'm gone this much?
I don't want you to be anyone but you, he said. And if you're sure nothing about us is bothering you,
it's not us. Nothing is wrong with us. I love us. Unless you want something new, that is. Just tell me and I'll shut up. Only not, because I never do. I cringed, then kissed him, because I knew that worked. He grinned as I pulled back.
I'm commissioning you a flight, as explorers, to map these planets. Recruit up to 3 other pilots. Just promise to come back and check in with me.
Every day, I promised, so long as I can manage it. He nodded, but he didn't seem certain, so I kissed him again, then added, softer, Jorgen,
I will come back every day that I can for time with you. This is where I belong. You belong wherever it's not boring.
I belong with all of you. Even if I need to do other things sometimes. Learning that is basically the point of half the stories, Jorgen.
Didn't you listen to Gran Gran? I thought those stories always left the heroine changed, he said.
They do. And they did.
In the stories, she leaves, because she no longer fits in where she began.
In the stories, yes, I whispered. But Jorgen, there's one huge flaw in all of those stories.
Which is?
None of them had you. I managed to get through to him with that one, I think. He smiled, then seemed actually a little bashful. If there's one thing that all of this has taught me, I said to him, it's that I get to choose for myself. I'll let you distract me with these planets to explore, Jorgen Waite. But don't you dare think it's going to give you too much of a break from me.
Wouldn't dream of it.
I let go of him, then went to show the data to Doomslug, Chet, Hesho, and Embot. But before I did, I called back to Jorgen. Hey, I said. By the way.
Yeah?
Just remember, if I accidentally unleash some kind of gigantic galactic threat, then I have to blow up a star or something to crush its skull and turn it into a red pulp the size of a planetary ring. This was your idea. He laughed and left me to it. Though the actual details weren't that important, so I let Hesho read them off to the others who chatted about where to go first. I stepped outside and looked up. There was an odd convergence taking place, a hole through the many layers of platforms that protected detritus, leading upward toward the stars. I belonged there,
but the lights that glowed in my friends were far brighter. I ducked back inside and asked Embot to call Kimmelin and tell her the good news. That I'd just dragged her into a potentially life-threatening adventure. Again. The end of the Skyward series. The universe will continue in Skyward Legacy. Acknowledgements. As always, a ton of work is done to put each and every one of these books together. I hope the list of names doesn't make your vision start to blur, but also, I hope you take the time to scan through and look at the many important people who are involved in the process. A few special highlights. Jancy Patterson has been an invaluable resource on this book and the Skyward series as a whole. You might know that she's working with me on a sequel series right now, which I hope you'll read. And if you missed Skyward Flight, the companion book to Cytonic, I highly recommend picking it up. Of the books in this series, it's rated by fan reviewers as one of the best. Another highlight is the cover of the US edition, which is probably our favorite cover illustration in the series, created by the always amazing Charlie Bowater. We've enjoyed working with Charlie on these books. It's been a wonderful experience. Finally, as always, a big thanks to my wife, Emily, Dragonsteel's chief operations officer and co-president. She is my partner in crime in all of this and works so hard behind the scenes to coordinate everyone on the large list below. Thank you all so much for reading. Brandon. At Jabberwocky, my literary agency, Eddie Schneider, Joshua Bilmes, Susan Velasquez, and Christina Zobel. At my U.S. publisher, Delacorte Press, Krista Marino was our fantastic editor on this, as for all of these books, and was a huge resource in helping us understand the YA audience and write the best stories possible. Plus, Beverly Horowitz, Lydia Grigovich, Colleen Fellingham, and Trisha Pravit. The copy editor was Carrie Ann Steinberg. At my UK publisher, Galance, Gillian Redfern, who also did a fantastic line edit on this book, Imad Akhtar, and Brendan Durkin. My audiobook narrators, Susie Jackson in the US and Sophie Aldred in the UK. Isaac Stewart is the VP of Dragonsteel's Creative Development Department. Ben McSweeney did the heavy lifting of creating and leading this project's art. Haley Lazo did the Tainix and Kitson pages. Anna Early led the art and design side of products for the book bundle, plus Rachel Lynn Buchanan, Jennifer Neal, and Priscilla Spencer. The industry standard Peter Alstrom is our editorial department VP, with Karen Alstrom, Christy Gilbert, Jenny Stevens, Betsy Alstrom, and Emily Shaw Hyam. Dan Wells is still the only person in Dragonsteel's narrative department. We considered buying him a goldfish, but figured it would be lonely. Matt, the innkeeper Hatch, is Dragonsteel's VP of Operations, with Jane Horn, Kathleen Dorsey Sanderson, McKenna Saluone, Hazel Cummings, and Becky Wilson. Adam Horn, a.k.a. Schrodinger's golfer, simultaneously being both the best and worst at golf in the company, is our VP of Publicity and Marketing, with Jeremy Palmer, Taylor D. Hatch, and Octavia Escamilla. Kara Stewart is our VP of Merchandising, Events, and Slug Wrangling. This book is dedicated to her, and you should all give her a huge amount of thanks and praise. Without her, none of you would have any of the cool merchandise we release, such as the wonderful Doom Slug plushies. Thank you very much, Kara, for all of your years of being awesome. Her department includes Emma Tam Stoker, Christy Jacobson, Kellen Newman, Lex Wilhite, Mem Grange, Michael Bateman, Joy Allen, Allie Reap, Richard Rubert, Katie Ives, Brett Moore, Dallin Holden, Daniel Phipps, Jacob Chrisman, Alex Lyon, Matt Hampton, Camilla Cutler, Quentin Martin, Esther Grange, Logan Reap, Laura Loveridge, Amanda Butterfield, Gwen Hickman, Donald Mustard III, Zoe Hatch, Pablo Mooney, Braden Moore, Avery Morgan, Nathan Mortensen, Christian Fairbanks, Dal Hill, George Kaler, Kathleen Barlow, Kaylee Arnold, Kitty Allen, Rachel Jacobson, Sydney Wilson, Caitlin Hatch, and Judy Torsak. My writing group, Here There Be Dragons, is Emily Sanderson, Kathleen Dorsey Sanderson, Peter Alstrom, Karen Alstrom, Darcy Stone, Eric James Stone, Alan Layton, Ethan Skarsted, Ben Olson, and Kaylin Zobel. Beta readers for this book were Rob West, callsign Larkspur, Brian T. Hill, callsign El Guapo, Kalyani Poluri, callsign Henna, Jaden King, callsign Tripod, Suzanne Musin, callsign Oracle, Shannon Nelson, callsign Greywatch, Glenn Vogelar, callsign Waze, Bao Pham, callsign Wild, Chris McGrath, callsign Gunner, Paige Vest, callsign Blade, Sam Baskin, callsign Turtle, Liliana Klein, callsign Slip, Ellen Maloney, Lindsay Luther, callsign Soar, Aubrey Pham, callsign Amerlin, Jesse Lake, callsign Lady, Eric Lake, callsign Chaos, Mark Lindberg, callsign Megalodon, Dina Covell Whitney, callsign Braid, Linnea Lindstrom, callsign Pixie, and Sarah Kane, callsign Ultraviolet. Gamma readers included many of the beta readers, plus Joao Menezes Morais, callsign Protected, Darcy Cole, callsign Blue, Ted Herman, callsign Cavalry, Jessica Ashcraft, callsign Gesh, Ross Newberry, callsign Punisher, Joe Dierdiff, callsign Traveler, Gary Singer, callsign DVE, Joshua Harkey, callsign Joshua, Tim Challoner, callsign Antaeus, Kendra Wilson, callsign K-Monster, Becca Rapert, callsign Grangran, Heather Klinger, callsign Nightingale, Aaron Ford, callsign Widget, Alexis Horizon, callsign Spectra, Ling Ting Botanica Shu, callsign Hassan, Sean Van Black, callsign Vanguard, Eliyahu Borelowitz Levin, callsign Archer, and Ian McNatt, callsign Weary. About the author. Brandon Sanderson is the author of the number one New York Times best-selling Reckoners series, Steelheart, Firefight, Calamity, and the e-original Mitosis, the number one New York Times best-selling Skyward series, Skyward, Starsight, Cytonic, and Defiant, as well as Skyward Flight, the collection with Jancy Patterson, the internationally best-selling Mistborn saga, and the Stormlight Archive. He was chosen to complete Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time series. His books have been published in more than 35 languages and have sold millions of copies worldwide. Brandon lives and writes in Utah. BrandonSanderson.com. About the narrator. Susie Jackson is an actress and voiceover artist whose voice has been heard on commercials, video games, cartoons, and over 200 audiobooks. An Audi Award winner and Sovas Voice Arts Award nominee, Susie was named one of the best voices by Audiophile magazine, and her books have been recognized on the American Library Association's Amazing Audiobooks for Young Adults list. About the producer. Eric Sinestvedt works in his home studio in Virginia, providing post-production for numerous publishers, producers, and narrators, including all of Brandon Sanderson's Secret Projects audiobooks. He was trained as a narrator for the Library of Congress Talking Books program, and also directed and proofed fellow narrators in the program. Previously, Eric was an actor and voiceover artist for more than 15 years, and has recorded over 300 audiobook titles. For more information and to contact, visit ericsinestvedt.com. This concludes Defiant by Brandon Sanderson, read by Susie Jackson. Post-production by Eric Sinestvedt. Produced by Dragonsteel. Copyright 2023. Text copyright 2023. All rights reserved. Visit our website at brandonsanderson.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.